I'm going to speak for about 20 minutes, so if you would, about 17 minutes, give me a high sign. I mean, you can bang on the table or something like that. And when the question period comes up, all of you are encouraged to ask questions of me on America, American Jews, and so on and so forth. I'm going to talk about the book here now, but, you know, don't hesitate to ask other questions. The book came about because of the success of Zionism in the age of the dictators. I have to say I was amazed. I never expected the London Times to give it a favorable review, but they did. That was a chance, fortuitous chance kind of thing. The Edward Mortimer happened to be an expert on the Middle East, and he happened, I was introduced to him and I gave him a copy of the book, not expecting him to review it, of course, but because he was an expert, he did, and he gave it a very favorable review, which is what led to Jim Allen picking up the book and so on and using it in perdition. Eventually, it was reviewed favorably by Izvestia, no less, and again, I come from a Trotskyist tradition. I did not expect a favorable review from the official organ of the Soviet Union. It was actually reviewed in 10 languages. It's hard to believe. And of course, I was here for the debate over perdition, which was a startling experience. If you don't know it, I don't know how you don't know it, how you could not know it. Perdition became, as a result of the Zionist attacks on it, one of the most famous plays in British theatrical history. It's kind of absurd, but such is the facts. Eventually, Zionism in the Age of the Dictators ran out of print, and I asked one of my publishers to renew it, and he said, no, because it's already gotten favorable reviews. It won't get reviewed again. They don't review reprints, which makes sense, I mean, if you think about it. So we decided that this time what I would do would be to publish the documents that I quoted in Zionism in the Age of the Dictators. So there are 51 documents. It says 51 documents on the book. Actually, there are 57 documents, but my publisher was very scrupulous. Six of the documents are documents establishing Zionism's connections to anti-Semitism and racism before Hitler. So they don't count as they indict, but they don't convict, if you follow me, all right? So the 51 documents are documents that are either from that period or post-war documents, including some documents about perdition, because thanks to the Zionists, perdition became a major part of the discussion of the Zionist role during the Holocaust. One of the documents, one of the six preliminary documents, kind of tells you where Zionism was at even before Hitler came to power. It's a document called Assimilation and Nationalism by the world's most famous Zionist, who of course was Albert Einstein. Okay? This is Einstein the scientist, okay? Nations with racial differences appear to have instincts which work against their fusion. The assimilation of the Jews to the European nations among whom they live in language, in customs, and to some extent even in the forms of religious organization could not eradicate the feeling of a lack of kinship between them and those among whom they live. In the last resort, this instinctive feeling of lack of kinship is referable to the law of conservation of energy. For this reason, it cannot be eradicated by any amount of well-meaning pressure. Nationalities do not want to be fused. They want to each go their own way. Now you can laugh, okay? Because all due respect, I think I understand Einstein's theory of relativity, and I have no quarrel with it, but what I just read you is pure and undistilled bullshit. There is no, number one, there is no law of conservation of energy in biology. Full stop, period. Punto finale, okay? But the idea that Jews can't mate with other people is, you must understand, a majority of the Jews of the world, young Jews of the world, are now intermarried. Okay? A majority. The only exception in the world is Israel and Australia, and we need not go into that. That's just an obscure little thing. They will be the majority, even in Australia, will intermarry. Someone can ask me a question later as to why they haven't yet, but that's neither here nor there. Okay. Now, what Einstein was doing was translating into Zionist terms the dominant ideology in the German academic world of his time, which number one, the academic world was minuscule compared to today, okay? And overwhelmingly of the rich and the middle class. No, poor people just did not go to school or to college in those days, not in Germany at any rate. And essentially the dominant ideology was Deutsche Blut und Deutsche Boden, German blood on German soil. So what he did and what the Zionists did was translate that into Jewish blood on Jewish soil. So that was the dominant ideology of the German Zionist movement and of the world Zionist movement when Hitler came to power. Now, Hitler comes to power, the Macht der Gerichtung, as it's called, on January 31st, 1933. In June of 1933, the Zionist Federation sent a secret document to the Nazis, which was not published until 1963 in German in Israel. It was later published in English in the United States, okay? But to my knowledge, I don't know, and I don't think it's ever been published in Hebrew in Israel.
A series of quotes.
Yeah, quotes, but you know, the full document, you know. Okay, now let me read you from it. Okay, this is the German Zionist Federation to the Nazis. Bear with me for a minute. I had an operation on my mouth, so. Okay. Zionism has no illusions about the difficulty of the Jewish condition, which consists above all in an abnormal occupational pattern and in the fault of an intellectual and moral posture not rooted in one's own tradition. Zionism recognized decades ago that as a result of the assimilationist trends, symptoms of deterioration were bound to appear, which it seeks to overcome by carrying out its challenge to transform Jewish life. It is our opinion that an answer to the Jewish question truly satisfying to the national state can be brought about only with the collaboration of the Jewish movement that aims at a social, cultural, and moral renewal of Jewry. They then go on, our acknowledgement of Jewish nationality provides for a clear and sincere relationship to the German people and its national and racial realities, precisely because we do not wish to falsify these fundamentals, because we, too, are against mixed marriage and are for maintaining the purity of the Jewish group and reject any trespass on the cultural domain. We have been brought up in the German language and culture. We can appreciate, but no trespass. Quote, for its practical aims, Zionism hopes to win the collaboration even of a government fundamentally hostile to the Jews. Because in dealing with the Jewish question, not sentimentalities are involved, but a real problem whose solution interests all people, and at the present moment, especially the German people. The realization of Zionism could only be hurt by resentment of Jews abroad against the German development. Boycott propaganda, such as being currently carried on against Germany in many ways, is in essence un-Zionist, because Zionism wants not to do battle, but to convince and to build. Now, what I tell people in America is that a lot of fellows who wrote letters like this to the Nazis in Europe got hung by the neck until dead after the war, all right? But since these were Jews, things went another way. Now, let me tell you how the collaboration actually worked, okay? That was written in June. By August of 33, they worked out a deal with the Nazis called the Haravara. Haravara means the transfer. Any German, Jewish, Gentile, didn't matter what, going out the door with money in 1933, which was the depths of the Depression, in fact, even before Hitler came to power, got nicked for 40%, let's say. All right? In other words, you lost 40% of your money as you went out the door. No one was letting money go out of their country in the middle of the Depression. But what Zionists and the Nazis did was worked out a deal where if a Jew gave, let us say, 20,000 Reichmarks to the German government would send 18,000 Reichmarks of, let us say, irrigation pipes to Palestine. The Zionists would then sell them there and give the Jew, when he arrived from Germany, 17,000 Reichmarks. Now that's still a lot better than losing your 40%. Okay? The problem was, from the Zionist perspective, they had a minuscule colony in 1933 to 39 at that time. In other words, it was about 12% of the population of Palestine in 33, and it was about 24% by 39. That's still very small. So they began to actually sell German goods all over the Middle East. Okay? They even tried to sell them here, but that was a little much, as we say in America, a little much, you know? And other Jews said, you know, just drop it or drop dead, one or the other, but no. Okay? To sum up the official policy of the World Zionist Organization, by 1937, they sent the Haganah, which later became the Israeli army, as you know, sent a man by the name of Feivel Polkus to Berlin to negotiate with the Nazis. Now, we know this because the Nazis, being good German bureaucrats, wrote down the report and put it in the files, okay? And after the war, it got discovered by the Americans, okay? And the guy who wrote the report was none other than Adolf Eichmann, okay? So he's describing Polkus. In Political Outlook, Polkus is a national Zionist. He is against all Jews who are opposed to the erection of a Jewish state in Palestine. As a Haganah man, he fights against communism and all strivings towards Arab-British friendship. He stated that he is ready to serve Germany and supply information as long as this does not oppose his political goal. Among other things, he is ready to stand by the interests of German foreign policy in the Middle East. He will try to find the German right, the oil sources without affecting British spheres of influence, all on the condition that Germany will assist Jewish immigration to Palestine and on the condition that Germany also ease the monetary regulations for these Jewish immigrants. Okay, so he goes to Berlin and he invites Eichmann, to come to Palestine, which he does. The British, however, when he got there, they realized there's something wrong with this guy. He claims to be a correspondent from a newspaper, but we know better, and they kicked him out, and he went to Cairo, and he met Polkus again, okay? And now again, we have Eichmann's report of what Polkus told him. Quote, this is Eichmann. In Jewish national circles, people are very pleased with the radical German policy, since the strength of the Jewish population in Palestine would be so far increased thereby that in the foreseeable future, the Jews could be reckoned upon, could reckon upon numerical superiority over the Palestinians. Now, the upshot of this was, after World War II, Eichmann, as we all know, was in hiding in Argentina before the Israelis caught him. But what most people don't know is that he was actually interviewed in Argentina by a Dutch Nazi journalist. And when he was caught, he took the document, he took the tapes to Life magazine, which at that time was the leading magazine in the United States, with a circulation of about 5 million a month, something like that. Okay. And they ran the tapes of Eichmann, okay? So in the tapes, we find this. In 1937, after I had been struggling with Hebrew for 2.5 years, I had a chance to take a trip to Palestine. We were most interested in the Palestine immigration, and I wanted to find out about at what point the Jewish state in Palestine might be set up. Unfortunately, Palestine was then in turmoil, and the British turned down my application. I did see enough to be very impressed with what the Jewish colonists were building up their land. I admired their desperate will to live, the more so since I myself was an idealist. In the years that followed, I often said to Jews whom I had dealings with that, had I been a Jew, I would have been a fanatical Zionist. I could not imagine being anything else. In fact, I would have been the most ardent Zionist imaginable. Okay? Now, I don't know if I assume you have it here, this being a capitalist country, but in America we have celebrity endorsements, okay? What I have just read you is the ultimate celebrity endorsement, okay? The ultimate, okay, all right. Now, but I want to emphasize something. All of this is the good Zionists that Chaim was talking about, Barak's Labor Party, the good Zionists. Now, I want to turn to the bad Zionists, all right? Who, in the eye of God, there's a difference, I guess. Okay? Okay, now. Vladimir Jabotinsky, as many of you know, was the founder of the Zionist Revisionist Movement, which is the ideological heart of the Likud Party. I don't think anybody could dispute that. He personally had lived in Italy for 3 years. He was a gifted linguist. He spoke perfect Italian, letter-perfect Italian. He liked the pre-Mussolini Italy, and when Mussolini came to power, he did not like Mussolini. He thought of him as a head buffalo, okay? However, because he was the ultimate colonialist, pith helmet colonialist of the time, he began to realize that the British were just using the Zionists, sort of like they use the Ulster, the Protestants in Northern Ireland. And he began to look around for another mandatory to take over. It had to be a rival to Britain. I mean, France wasn't going to take over or something like that. So, sure enough, he began to orient towards Mussolini, and eventually Mussolini set up a Bitar, which is the youth group of the Zionist revisionists, set up a squadron of Bitarites at Mussolini's Naval Academy. Now, I'm just going to read you a little bit from La Idea Sionistica, their publication in Italy at the time. Remember, they're legal, since they, after all, they have people in the Naval Academy. They're completely legal. I'm just going to read you a couple of little things. The rabbi's benediction. This is at the opening of their squadron. The order, attention! A triple chant ordered by the squad's commanding officer. Viva l'Italia! Viva il re! Viva il duce! Then Giovinezza was sung with much enthusiasm by the Bitarim, some still awkward with the Italian language. They're not all linguists. This year there are 49 cadets. Our human material is extremely intelligent. The majority are university students, and 30 of them belong to the Giovinetto Universitaria Fascista, the Italian, the fascist university youth. In other words, they were members of the Italian fascist movement. They weren't just pro-Mussolini. They joined his movement, okay? All of them became the founders of the Israeli Navy. It was founded by members of the Italian fascist party. Okay, full stop, period. Eventually, Mussolini broke with the Zionists and with the Jews because over Spain. He realized that he had to beat the loyalists in Spain. If they won, it would be the end for him. Okay, and it would inspire the Italian working class. So he kicked them out. Okay. He kicked the Zionists out because he couldn't be allied to Hitler in Spain and have Jews at your naval academy and Jews in your cabinet. So he kicked them all out. Okay, but when you have a movement that has joined the fascist party and something like that happens, At least some of them have to rationalize that. Okay? So a wing led by Avraham Stern, who later founded what everybody calls the Stern Gang, decided, look, let's give Il Duce a break. He did his best. He was pro-Zionist. And those ingrates, the Jews, they wouldn't go for it. So, he tried, wouldn't go for it, he kicked them out. Now, it's our job to convince him and his ally, Mr. Hitler, that we really are fascists, okay? So, sure enough, and I'm closing on this, I mean, you can relax, okay? Sure enough, in 1940, Stern sent a document to the Nazis. Again, it was found by the Allies in Turkey, in the German embassy in Turkey after the war. There's no doubt about its reality. And I'm just going to read you a little bit. The National Military Organization, which is well acquainted with the goodwill of the German Reich government and its authorities towards Zionist activity inside Germany and towards Zionist immigration plans, is of the opinion that, one, common interests could exist between the establishment of a new order in Europe in conformity with the German concept and the true national aspirations of the Jewish people as they are embodied by the NMO. Cooperation between the new Germany and a renewed Volkisch national Hebraism would be possible, and three, the establishment of the historic Jewish state on a national and totalitarian basis bound by a treaty with the German Reich would be in the interest of a maintained and strengthened future German position of power in the Near East. Proceeding from these considerations, the NMO in Palestine, under the condition that the above-mentioned aspirations of the Israeli freedom movement are recognized on the side of Germany, offers to actively take part in the war on Germany's side. As I said, in Europe, they hunger for that. In Israel, They elected Yitzhak Shamir, who was one of the three people who took over the Stern Gang after the British killed him. They elected him prime minister, and he was prime minister for 7 years. Okay? I mean, if you think about Kurt Waldheim, for example, right, and all the ferocity that came out against him, Israel had a wannabe Nazi prime minister. It went over like a Led Zeppelin as far as the average American Jew, the average Jew in the world was concerned. Never heard of it. Most of them never heard of it. Okay? But it's true. Now, in the question period, I hope you ask me a lot of questions so I can go on to deal with other aspects of the thing. But isn't it an accident that a movement that collaborated with the Nazis, both wings, each in different ways, but unmistakably collaborated, that allied itself to apartheid, okay, that told American Jews to vote for Richard Nixon, because he was giving them guns during the 73 war and so on and so forth. Is it an accident that George Bush is their ally today? No. They have to seek their allies among the most reactionary elements in world politics. Because the left wants the assimilation of the Jews. In other words, full rights in Britain, in the United States, in whatever country. It's only these bizarre elements that are themselves racist that give Zionism the time of day. I'll close on this because you're all here and we can discuss it in the question period, but I'd like to thank Roland and the others here for inviting me to the talk. Thank you.